Hello, everybody. This is Jim David, and happy 2014. I'm very excited about 2014. I'm going to be performing all over the place, and hopefully I will be coming to a comedy club near you. One way to find out is to follow me on Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter at Comic Jim David. I'm always looking for more Twitter followers. Also, you can still order my novel, You'll Be Swell. It's still selling on Amazon, Kindle, iPad, and iTunes. But anyway, enough of that. I'm very excited about this podcast, the first of the new year. This is a guy named Del Shores. Now, you may not know the name Del Shores, but you probably definitely know his work. He's most famous for his play and movie called Sordid Lives. I mean, Del is originally from Texas, and talk about using your life. You know, he really has used, you know, they always say write what you know. Well, this guy's done that. He's used his life for fodder again and again. His first play was called Daddy's Dying, Who's Got the Will, and it became a movie in 1990. And his latest work is a film version of his play Southern Baptist Sissies. But Del also has been a big television writer for many years. He wrote on Queer as Folk and Dharma and Greg and Ned and Stacey and quite a lot of other things. I mean, when you listen to this guy, you'll realize it's actually very inspiring. And it's also inspiring for me as a writer just to listen to what he has to say. But anyway, happy 2014. Thanks for listening. And I really hope that you enjoy this interview with Del Shores.
You were raised in Texas. Where in Texas?
Early childhood Winters, Texas.
Never heard of it.
It's very tiny. I just was there for my Aunt Sissy's ash spreading. not her funeral, her ash spreading. She said she did not want any of those people who were talking behind her back at her funeral. So she just wanted to select people. And so I went there, and it said the sign said 2376 lived there, but my Aunt Bobby Sue said about 1,000 of them have died, so nobody moves in. Then later, that was early childhood, then went to Zapata, Texas. My dad was a preacher, and that's another tiny town in South Texas.
What kind of preacher?
The Southern Baptist.
Yeah.
So my mother was a high school drama teacher. My dad was a Southern
Baptist.
Was
he like the kind of Southern Baptist minister we have today, which is says you have to round up all the gays and put them behind an electric fence?
No, my dad was. That was that pastor in North Carolina, and I have a theory about what's happened with us with the gay community, that we're making progress with equality. And it has activated the religious riot again. There are those kind of pastors. My dad certainly preached against homosexuality, though.
He did.
Yeah, absolutely. He was absolutely, and I was closeted for years as a and I always say, when anybody from the South goes, how did you go down that road of, you know, you were married, you had two kids, and I go, I was a Southern Baptist preacher's kid, and they go, oh, okay, I get it. You know, there's just so much damage, and that's why I've written, you know, Southern Baptist Sissies and a lot in Sordid Lives about the damage that happens when kids hear that hatred that's spewed in the name of the Lord in pews.
And so, see, I feel lucky because, I mean, I was raised Southern Methodist.
Right.
But my parents were, it's like I've seen the good that the church can do because the church was a very important community for them.
Right.
But there was none of this social shit from the pulpit of my church. It was all about redemption and salvation and loving one another.
Right.
And I never heard one word about homosexuals from my minister.
Well,
not one word.
I think that in a lot of denominations don't, and we have a lot of progress in the denominations who have been, and especially within Hearts of Christians. But there are still these so-called Christians who spew this anger and this hatred toward, and I think it's some way to justify their own homophobia. But in that, my dad was a great pastor. My dad was good to his people.
Is he living?
No. My dad is pastor.
Did you ever come out to him?
Oh yeah.
And
it was initially the response was, I love you. You're welcome in my home. I don't approve of this lifestyle. I will never.
This lifestyle.
Yeah, this lifestyle. And your kids are welcome, but I will never. I never want to talk about this again. And I did talk to him about it, but I would confront him, and I would give him other scriptures, and And ultimately, when my dad, the last thing my dad said to me was, he said, I've never understood you, but I do want you to be happy. And for me, that was enough.
That's enough.
You know, he gave me what he could.
Well, that's good.
So, you know, Leslie Jordan, my buddy Leslie Jordan, he always says, you know that, honey, they just did the best with what they were given.
Nobody gave them a pamphlet as to how to do this. Nobody gave them. I mean, when I came out to my parents, I had to send them all this literature.
Right.
Because, like, you know, now that you know what every parent you write and
exactly.
what the Bible really says about homosexuality. Yeah. And then I gave them a book called My Son Eric by this woman who was a Southern Methodist or something, very conservative religious belief, and she was dealing with her gay son. You know, they're not given any template as to how to deal with this. I mean, nor are they given a template to deal with if their child comes home with a black person.
That's right.
I mean, it's the same thing. You know, it's like if I had been dating a black girl, I think that would have been worse for my parents.
You know, my friend James Duff, who created The Closer, I don't know if you know James, but
I know who it is.
He's from Lubbock, Texas. And he said, Dale, the only reason my parents were okay with me being gay is that my first boyfriend was black and the black trumped the gay. And he said they were just relieved after I got broke up with him. So, you know, there's a lot of racism. There's a lot of so much that, I mean, look, the Southern Baptists apologized to the black community in 1995 for their stance on slavery and their stance on racism, which they justified with scriptures, through the scriptures.
Yeah.
So I keep telling people, come to my Facebook page and they write horrible things, these so-called Christians, because I'm very vocal about it. And I go, welcome to the wrong side of history. Because someday your grandchildren are going to be ashamed of what you're... It's going to make no sense to them. Mm-hmm. They're going to be, what?
Mm-hmm.
I can't wait till Southern Baptist Sissies is a historic piece where people look at that movie and they go, wow, that's the way it was? Really?
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, I wrote that play in 2000, and it's 13 years later, and it is more timely today than it was back then because a lot of... like you pointed out, the preacher in South Carolina, or it was in North Carolina, I believe.
Yeah.
It has activated.
I'm against it. God's against it.
Yeah.
And if you have any sense, you're against it. I'll never forget that.
And that's going to get rid of us,
mm-hmm.
to round this all up.
How did you start writing?
You know, I was one of the... I many times I say I'm a storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
I started writing because I had two sides of the family. I had... you know, my dad's family was very, very religious, and they were good people, good Christians, Southern Baptists. My mother's side of the family, they were also Southern Baptists, but they were the backsliding Baptists, and they were drinking and then repenting and marrying, and there was so much, I gravitated to those sinners. I was always amazed, and my mother's family... My dad would say, don't tell stories, son, because I would come in as a little boy and I would just make up shit. I mean, like, big, tall tales. Like, Daddy, guess what I did today? You know, I rode over the mountain on a wild turkey with Nana, and we had a tea party.
And it was all fake.
It all made up. And my dad'd say, son, don't tell stories. But my mother's side of the family, they would go, Dilford, what else happened? They'd just egg me on. And so, and my mother always allowed me to lie creatively. As long as, she said, if it doesn't hurt anybody, Dub, that was my dad's nickname. She said, if it doesn't hurt anybody, why are you having a hard time with this? And so my mother had that creative edge to her. And when I was in junior high, I wrote my first play, but my passion was acting. So I kept acting. And I always say, my writing has always been an extension of my acting. I went to L.A. to be an actor,
mm-hmm.
and I was doing a soap opera, and, you know, not a contract player, just the bartender, Seth, and Shenanigans, who had, here's your drink, Jim.
Yeah.
And I wanted more, and so I wrote a play so I could be in it. And
what was that one?
It was called Cheatin'. And I didn't know what I was doing. I just was writing. At that point, I was writing two character scenes for acting class, and I constructed a play structurally that had two character scenes that were just an overlap of characters. And I got great reviews for the style, which was just insecurity on my end. And then when that was going on, my mother's father, my pawpaw, was having these progressive strokes. And there was this war going on with my aunts and my mother. And that produced a play called Daddy's Dying, Who's Got the Will.
Well, I saw that movie.
And that
changed. I realized that I saw that movie with Beverly D'Angelo.
Judge Reinhold. Bridges.
Right.
Keith Carradine.
Right. And great cast. That was directed by Sissy Spacek's husband, Jack Fisk. Who's usually David Lynch's art director.
Who went back to that. I mean, he directed like Raggedy Man, Daddy's Dying. That was about it.
Oh, okay.
And then he went back and David Lynch was his brother-in-law, married to Jack's sister. And by the way, read Sissy's autobiography. It's fantastic. It's like
Sissy Spacek.
Yeah, she's got an autobiography out.
Well, you know what? When you were talking about your family, and there was so much of that kind of craziness in that piece, Daddy's Dying, with the just the hypocrisy mm-hmm. of the family that they're ostensibly these religious people, or proper Southern folks, and they're all trying to kill each other.
Right. It's like, well, that's what happened.
They're all trying to get the money.
I created a reunion that just brought all of the demons out. And it was, and yes, the money was a spark that created, like, but you stole my boyfriend. I mean, all this other shit started coming out. And I didn't have a part for me in that play. I just wrote it, and then I sat back as the writer for the first time, and it was the one that took off.
Did you ever take any playwriting courses, or did you just write?
No, but I was a kid that read a book a day, and I read plays.
I read
Tennessee Williams, and my mother was the high school drama teacher, so Samuel French would send us a stack every summer.
Oh, wow, so you had some clue.
I always tell, when I teach writing now, I go, the best thing that you can do as a young writer is not take every course about structure. It's read. Read plays. Go to plays, go to theater, learn it that way, because I just had an organic sense of storytelling, and playwriting allowed me to have the freedom, because with movies, with television, there's a bit more structure, but I could create my structure because I go, okay, I know that Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, I know it has 9 scenes in the first act. I knew that Tennessee Williams broke so many rules, and I thought, oh, then there are no rules. So I can have, and Daddy's Dying was a very structured play, but then you look at Southern Baptist Sissies, and it weaves all over the place. It just goes from one scene to another, and the lighting sort of takes you on that journey. So,
that was my text.
I love it. I love it. It's like we're having scoring.
I know. Let me turn the volume down.
So so I was self-taught basically, but in that I studied. You know what I mean? I studied the classics. I love literature. I love theater. And my mother was the one who, every summer when I was a kid, even before I was in high school, those plays would arrive, and she said, "Delford, help me out.
Delford.
You read half of them, and I'll read half of them, and the ones you like, I'll read." So that's what I was. She just used me. I would read. I go, "This one's good," and I'd give her a synopsis of it, and that.
You know what? One of my favorite plays is Streetcar.
It is my favorite play.
It is. Yeah. Well, my one-man show, South Pathetic, is about me directing the worst production of Streetcar ever done at the worst community theater in North Carolina.
Oh, you get bad actors in that one.
I end up doing a 6-minute version of Streetcar at the end of it.
Did you record? Do you have this on video? I would love to see
that. It's a scream. You'd get it.
I love it.
Because it's all Southern, and it's a scream. But anyway, my mother always hated Tennessee Williams because she just thought it was about a bunch of trashy people. And why in the world do you want to spend any time with these people at all? And she just didn't get it. She's the kind of woman who likes the Hallmark Channel.
But
she likes pleasant things.
But what she was saying, which is what I gravitate to in my work, and is I loved how he created characters that were flawed.
Oh,
God. They're so flawed. And, I don't know if you know that great story about, when Thornton Wilder was the playwright of the day when Streetcar was written. And Williams, I think, had Glass Menagerie. And that wasn't, I think that Streetcar was his second big success. And so they brought Thornton Wilder to a reading of that play.
Of Streetcar.
Of Streetcar. And, you know, Sword and Wild are very safe with our town and, you know, it's pretty.
Well, The Skin of Our Teeth is my favorite play of all time.
So, well, but they bring him in and they go, you know, Mr. Wilder, after the reading, what did you think? And he said, there's a big flaw. This play will never work. And Tennessee Williams is sitting there and they go, you know, out of respect, why won't it work? And he goes, because that woman would never stay with the brute of a man like Stanley.
And you mean Stella would never stay with Stanley.
That's what he was saying. That's the flaw of the play. That's what Thornton Wilder said. And he walks out of the room, and Tennessee Williams goes, "That man has never had a good fuck in his life." So that
may be true.
That's
the whole point, is because, like, you know, Stella, the reason she stays with Stanley is because he's the greatest fuck in the world. And it's made very clear, you know, after that horrible night when he screams Stella and she comes down those stairs. And the scene in the movie when Kim Hunter comes down the stairs to Marlon Brando has to be one of the most erotic things put on the screen ever, including porn.
Yeah.
It is so hot, you know, because you can see that she's just, oh.
Well, and that was one of those. That's a great example of when you cast right, you cast right. But I mean, the psychology of that. And for me, I don't know, but I'm sure with your writing, you do. I try to scratch deep into the psychology of characters. I always go, okay, in, you know, my play, The Trials and Tribulations of a Trailer Trash Housewife, which was about spousal abuse. Again, you go to that place. Why does she stay? He's beat the shit out of her for 19 years. She is in this horrible existence. Why does she stay? And I started doing research because there's so many women who stay in that. And, okay, I know why she stays. Because she needs to be loved.
Mm-hmm.
No self-esteem.
Who else is going to love me?
And she said, that's what she says. She says, nobody loves me like he does. Nobody. And so there's this, you see, like, these women who are in prison for killing their husband. But what they did, they needed validation.
Yeah.
They would pick the fight. So they would be beaten. So then he would come and make up, because it's a vicious cycle.
Now,
so
where did Sordid Lives pop out of?
Well, Sordid Lives, it was my coming out play. I had been in a marriage for, you know, 10 years.
You were married for 10 years?
For 10 years.
When you got married, did you know you were gay?
I knew I was attracted to men.
Oh.
I didn't define myself. It's what I did not want to be because of the damage of the church, of the self-loathing that I had of that part of me. I did not want to be gay.
Uh-huh.
So when I finally dealt with that, I went to a lot of therapy, and Sordid Life started with me writing my therapy sessions down. And it started also, I wrote a little short story. I tried to do, you know, like you with your book, I tried to do long form, and I wrote a short story called Nicotine Fit. And it was about Sissy trying to quit smoking for 3 days, and she just picked the wrong time to quit, that her sister died. And then the nieces descended, and they started fighting over this mink stole. Because I just took it from my mother's and my aunt's. And when my grandfather died, there was this big fight about, is that Pawpaw, my Aunt Rita, wanted him to wear this cowboy hat in the coffin. And my mother's he's going to look ridiculous wearing that. They compromised. Finally, he had it on him like this, you know, on his stomach, holding it. But so I just started writing that. And then there was a mention in that story about Ty, the gay son.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized, okay, that's me. And I started, you know, again, scratching deep. And it's a sprawling, weird tale. It's what, when I started directing, by the way, was Sordid Lives, because everybody that I showed it to direct it, they go, you got like 3 plays here. And I go, no, I understand how it works. I go, fuck it. And I just came out to my Southern Baptist preacher dad. I don't have to fear critics. I'll just direct it.
I'm not afraid of that. So was it a big hit immediately?
Yeah. It was. I always say the Sordid Lives was the most amazing gift to myself, because I was still really having a hard time with being okay with being gay. And I must tell you, when those audiences started piling in and clapping and standing on their feet every single night, and then ran for 13 months and won a lot of LA awards, every night when I would hear that, I would go, They're clapping because they're okay with me being gay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm okay. It's a look. They're applauding this. They're applauding this crazy, crazy dysfunction that I grew up with.
I had the same kind of a feeling when I came out on stage for the first time. Because I'd done stand-up for like 10 years, but I never talked about being gay on stage. Mm-hmm. I thought the sky was going to fall. Right. I thought I'd have no career.
Right.
And I was performing for all exclusively straight people.
Right.
But then I thought, you know what? And I got sick of all these comedians talking before me and doing all this homophobic shit. And they can talk about their wives and their girlfriends, and I'm in a relationship that's better than any of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried it. And not only did it work, it perked up the audience, and they wanted to hear about it.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden, and it still happens when I'm doing Atlantic City, I'm doing Atlanta. Half of those people don't know I'm gay when they walk in the door.
Right.
I mean, my fans do.
Right. I think, I haven't played a lot of straight clubs, but a few with Caroline, when I opened for Caroline Ray, and I remember doing, I was kind of scared. I remember being scared about, not scared about being gay or owning that I was gay. I was scared they're just not going to laugh. They're not going to get this shit because, I mean, and then I found, wow, the humor is kind of universal because I storytell. Where was it? What's the club in Nashville?
Zanies.
So we were playing Zanies, Caroline Knight. I was before her, and I said, hey, I don't know. Last time I was here, I played play over by, you know, in the gay on Church Street. So I want to know how many straight people are here and how many women. Blah. And I said, where are the gay boys? And there were like 30 or 40 there that night because I was there and they're screaming and being gay. And then, just as the laughter dies down, this guy with a cap on, you know, looks like he drove a truck with a gun in the glove compartment. He goes, ugh. And I thought, okay, you know, that fleeting moment, do I acknowledge this? And I go, and so I did. I said, did you just say ugh because of the gay boy screaming? And he goes, yeah. And I go, okay, I look at the audience, because Caroline taught me this. She said, don't get them, don't be mean to them, make the audience turn on.
Exactly.
Make the audience laugh at them. Because
you're only going to lose. If you start to get mean to them, it just don't work.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've done that, and it takes a while to get that audience back. And I said, let's just educate the straight boy here. I go, look, it's not going to travel and go into you. It's not going to hop off stage. You're not going to be sucking a cock by the end of the night. And the audience was screaming.
Of course.
In Nashville.
You have to have a lot of lines prepared.
I didn't have any that prepared. I've used them before, those again.
Yeah, sure.
It's another time after they succeeded that night. But I just kind of just flew. And
yeah.
And I even went further because his girlfriend started laughing. I thought, oh, now I got it.
Good.
God, I got it. So I said, and don't worry. If you need to go to the bathroom, I don't want you to have any fear at all. Because even if all 30 of those boys are in there, nobody's going to hit on you because we prefer people who are more attractive.
That'll do it.
And so everybody laughed. And then at the end, the security, the owner came and he said, I'm going to have security walk you out just in case. He goes, you are in Nashville.
That's hilarious. But now the movie of Sordid Lives, how did you raise that money yourself?
I did. I did. Well, I certainly had help with, I had a great best friend, producing partner, Sharon Lane, who produced the film with me. And Sharon and I sat down. I remember
being, let me ask you this. Did you submit it to studios or something?
Yes, I did. I was with ICM at the time. I submitted they submitted it to many studios who turned it down. Many.
Why'd they turn it down?
They just didn't. It was too indie. It was too, there was, you know, I mean, look, Sordid Lives is a mess. It's just all over the place. It's a beautiful mess. It comes together and nobody got it. Uh-huh. Nobody got it. And so...
So you decided to go the self-produced route?
Yeah, there was I wish I knew his name, but this guy approached me in a bookstore one day, and he came up to me, and I was with my daughter, and he kept looking at me, and I thought, am I being cruised in front of my kid? You know, she was about 9 at the time, and he walks up to me, and he said, are you Del Shores? I go, yeah, and he goes, I want to tell you that I saw Sordid Lives on stage, and because I saw Sordid Lives, he said, I'm 44 years old. He said, I flew back to Oklahoma, and I came out to my Southern Baptist family. And he said, I thought if he can do it through humor, if he can make me laugh and do it that way, I can do it too. And oh, the rest of the story was, he said, I heard you were, that you once, in an article, I heard that you wanted, that you've written a screenplay. And I said, yeah, but I said, I don't think it's going to happen because, you know, my agent can't seem to get financing for it, blah, blah, blah. He goes, would you do me a favor? Would you just really try to make it happen? And that was so I went and I told Sharon that, and she said, okay, we're going to make this happen. And the next week we were going to New York for some reason, and we sat in her apartment in New York, and we wrote down every rich friend that we had who would not miss $50,000. And we got a list of about 15, and we called every single person.
I don't have that many rich friends. Well, I got a couple.
She was good with that. I mean, you know, her ex-husband created Married with Children, and she put half of the money into the movie. I mean, we started with the movie cost $500,000. Sharon put in $250,000. And then we had to raise an additional, after we got it in the can, we had to raise an additional $190,000.
How did you end up directing a movie if you'd never directed a movie before?
Well,
how'd you know where to put the camera? How'd you know how to light it? Is this all the DP?
Have you seen it?
Yeah, I've seen part of it.
Well, no, the lighting's for shit, so I didn't know how to light it.
Oh, it is?
No, I got a DP. Here's what happened.
I'm just curious as to how you march in and direct a movie if you've never done
it. I knew how to direct actors. I told the DP, I said, look, I've got to have help with the camera. And I worked really hard in the months that preceded it of learning the 180 and just self-taught once again, and meeting with him and designing the shots that I knew I had to do it simply. I knew that it was going to be those characters
right.
that drove that movie.
And also, it's probably because of the budget, you couldn't do a lot of retakes.
No, you couldn't. But it was one of the very first high-def movies, so I could...
It was not on film.
No, I rehearsed it like a play. We then transferred it to film in a process.
Oh, okay.
But we shot it on video. And that's why the lighting, it looks kind of... I mean, it's just harsh. I always say... Three actresses got facelifts because of that movie, because of the lighting in that movie. But it was one of those journeys that you know, we just took a risk. I didn't know.
How in God's name did you get Olivia Newton-John in it?
Well, Olivia was my friend.
Oh.
Her sister Rona, who was actually the therapist, Ty's therapist, she's just an extra in it. She just passed away. But she's my best friend, and one of my best friends. And Olivia had become a friend because she loved my plays, and she came to all my plays, and she had seen Sordid Lives, and one day she called me on my birthday and said, what are you doing? I said, I'm trying to raise the money for Sordid Lives, and I'm getting there. I said, you know what would help? If I could just get some stars attached. And she said, hey, well, I could play the singer. And I'm like, are you serious? And she said, well, if you could teach me the accent, I perhaps, you know, let me think about it. So I called Rona and I said, you've got to get her to do this. I can teach her that accent. And so 2 days later, I met with Olivia and Mark Hartley, her manager. She's still with him. And she said, okay. And so she was the first person to come on board. And once she came on board with that letter of intent, and then, Beau Bridges was the first to come, and then Olivia, because Beau came to see the play, and he said, Del, if you do the movie, I want to wear that black bra. And then I had Beverly D'Angelo attached to it, and she was having some Al Pacino problems, and she bowed out, and then I got Delta. I just sent it.
Delta Burke.
I say, when I got Rue McClanahan for the series, I just looked on IMDb. I found her manager. I called her. And I said, Barbara Lawrence. And she said, I don't know who you are. I said, what's the network logo? Oh, Christ, it doesn't pay anything, does it? And I go, no. And she said, well, Rue makes me send her everything that's offered to her. And 2 days later, Rue calls me. And she said, I love this character.
And that's it.
She said, and so she was in for scale, you know.
God. That's great, though.
And Leslie and Beth, of course, were in the play, so they had taken the journey. With everybody else was in the play. And Bonnie Bedelia came because Jim Eckard, the costumer, had worked with her before, and we had gone through a lot of people for Luttrell, and that Mary Steenburgen had read it, had a conflict, but talked to me, loved it, and Mary Kay Place. And so they just all came together. I always say the movie gods smiled upon me. And
what a stroke of luck.
Yeah.
Well, that's what you're doing is you're creating your own almost genre. There's a Del Shore genre.
Well, there has I've been really lucky because of Sordid that because Southern Baptist Sissies, the new film that is in all the film that's coming into all the film festivals right now, it was completely fan funded, completely crowdfunded. We did it on Indiegogo, and I now that we have better cameras and I know how to light and I know, you know, what we shot 10 days with I staged the play and shot it for $175,000.
What made you decide to shoot it as a filmed play with an audience as opposed to opening it up and doing it like a real movie?
Honestly, I had done that. And I was Funny Boy Films was going to produce it a few years ago, and the funding fell through and the whole thing fell apart. And I have to tell you, in hindsight, I mean, although I hate that happened, it is a better movie as a result of that. The journey was supposed to be what it was. It works so well as a staged play because it is truly a film, but it is the play. My whole concept was I want the film audience to come in and feel as if they're going to the theater, yet feel like they're watching
a film. I can't wait to see this because that's hard to do. How often do you write?
I write head-wise on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just hit it and I write till it's done. Mm-hmm. The last couple of years I've gone through, you know, this kind of bad divorce and I got...
You had a divorce from your husband.
My husband. And that honestly emotionally crippled me to a degree that I could not write. Well, and I go, I didn't write. Well, yet I did, you know, another tour. And I wrote everything that was on stage. So, you know, that's writing, too.
Didn't I read somewhere that you went through some financial nightmare?
Yeah, oh, horrible, horrible. That preceded the divorce. And
what happened?
What happened was I decided, you know, at age 49, I was at the 49 at the time, I had just come off of Queer as Folk, had plenty of money in the bank, and, you know, my great house, and I thought...
You had just come off of Queer as Folk?
Queer as Folk.
Oh, you were writing it.
I wrote and produced that show for 3 years.
Right.
So the last three seasons.
This is the American Queer as Folk, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I decided I want my own show, and I met with Logo about Sordid Lives, and it went into development, and it took 4 years. And here I keep renewing my contract with them for like $5,000 to option the series, no money at all, and us trying to put the financing together. I ultimately took control back from them, put the financing together through a foreign company, through a company called Once Upon a Time, and IMG was the foreign, and then Logo brought in the rest of the money. What happened is I created a show that was their number one show. They had never had a scripted show like that, and they ordered a second season, and while we were waiting for the foreign company to come in for their second season, because we needed all the money, the producer, who owned the show, decided not to pay our residuals. Just decided not to pay them. And so, you know, on Logo, the shows are running on a loop. And that was the way, and at that point, my money had just, I mean, I stopped working in television except for Sordid Lives because I was exclusive, and my money just dwindled into it. And I thought, no, but it's okay. I got a hit show now. And ultimately, 2 years later, with WGA, DGA, AFTRA, fighting him, we were awarded $2.7 million. But the show was gone. And that was on a Friday, and on Monday, he filed bankruptcy, and we got nothing.
Oh my God!
And I wrote 12 episodes and directed them, so you can imagine how much money of that 2.7. When you think about it, it was the actors and me, and I was 2/3 of the puzzle with the guilds.
God.
So I lost my home, and but it's all a journey, and that was a horrible time. Yes.
How's life now?
Life is great. I mean, I've gotten to the point, I'm at a place in my life where, first of all, I don't work with assholes anymore. I trust my gut. because my gut always told me not to work with that producer. And as a result of that, because my hands were tied, contractually bound to somebody who was owing me money and I was in litigation, I couldn't do TV.
And, oh my God.
And that's why I started doing stand-up. That I wrote a one-man show called Del Shore's My Sordid Life, which was how it was about...
And you've been touring with that.
I started with that one. By that time, I was confident enough that I go, okay, I can do this.
And well, you're you seem like such a survivor. I mean, you've been through so many lives.
What's your choice? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's either that or just kill yourself, you know? And
well, I'm going to kill myself.
So...
Yeah, I'm going to kill myself. I've had enough. That's great. And also, but thank you for talking to me. You've made a lot of people happy with your work.
Well, they've made me happy, honestly. I mean, you know, look at here. I walk in, and you know how it is. And you see it. You walk out there, and they laugh, and you laugh. And if someone asked me today, they go, "Is it hard to?" And I go, "Is it hard to go out and speak and tell your stories and?" People laugh and you're adored. No, it's absolutely wonderful. I mean, I love what I do. Still my eyeballs and come back full of sockets.